In the news.
Welcome to In the News for American and Texas Government. I'm Eric McDaniel.
And I'm Jim Henson.
Well, it's great to see you all again for this last segment for the semester. One of the things we want to start off with is we've been starting off with all semester long, the primaries. And so we're starting to see things shape up. The primary season has lasted longer than normal, but we're starting to see things shape up. Look, going to the Democratic side, we see Bernie Sanders, after having several losses last week, gets a big win in Indiana by capturing 52.5% of the vote.
Yeah, it's kind of probably a too little too late, given that Hillary Clinton, they close to split the delegates. They split the delegates 43 for Sanders, 37 for Hillary Clinton. So it's probably a little too little too late for Bernie. Nonetheless, I'm sure the Clinton team would really have just preferred that they had been able to just win this clean, come in first place in this, and get the kind of scenario that we're seeing over on the other side.
Yeah, so now if we go to the other side, what we see, the big winner is Donald J. The J stands for Fantastic Trump, who captured 53.3% of the vote in Indiana, followed by Ted Cruz with 36.6%, and I'm never giving you up, John Kasich with 7.6% of the vote. One thing I can say about John Kasich is he ain't a quitter.
And the big news there is, that basically Trump got all of the delegates, and that was really the sign for Trump, I think, that it was over. So if we go and we look at the delegate count in both of these races, Donald Trump, a very good lead right now. All the talk that we've been discussing, the brokered convention, we've gone back and forth about that, looking less and less likely now. Trump breaks 1,000 last night. He's just a little over, needs just a little over 200 to go. And there's still, a few hundred delegates left. So Trump is in very good shape. Cruz saw the writing on the wall. And I think, we can talk about the Cruz dropping out and what that means. On the Democratic side, looks closer than it is. And if you look at the pledged delegate count, Clinton holds a sizable but not insurmountable lead. But then when you plug in the superdelegates, which we've talked about over and over again here, those Democratic Party officials that get to pledge to whoever they want, Hillary Clinton has something like 5 times as many, or like 10 times, more than 10 times as many superdelegates as Bernie has. And so that's just going to be almost impossible to overcome. And so after a semester of talking about this and looking at the back and forth, even though Bernie Sanders is still in it, Kasich is still in it, the general election is taking shape, and it's going to be Donald J. Trump versus Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, I mean, one thing is important to note is that Sanders, he's kind of said, look, there's a good chance I'm not going to win. But one of the things he's pushing for is really, for a while there, the Sanders supporters were attacking the superdelegates, saying, you're going to steal this election from us, or steal this primary from us. Now they're realizing the only way they can really win is by getting the superdelegates. So it's gone from the kicking and punching and pulling your hair to, hey, let's go out for a nice romantic dinner. And so it's one of these weird things where the Bernie supporters have gone from, as we pointed out a couple weeks ago with the delegate hit list, but it was basically a delegate call list where they're calling up the delegates, yelling at the delegates for not supporting Bernie. Now they're saying, oh, baby, I'm sorry. Let's go out for a nice dinner, Chianti, and look at the moonlight together. Let me show you how much I love you. So put on some Teddy Pendergrass in the back. Come and go with me. Come on over to my place. Again, if y'all don't know that song, your parents do. That's why you're here. All right, but again, you're seeing this kind of bipolar thing as they're realizing the delegates are going to hurt us. Now we need the delegates. So it's kind of going back and forth is one of the things that's really important to pay attention to as we're seeing really the Sanders campaign trying to save this, or at least try to get a contested convention at the minimum.
Yeah, and the big news coming out of last night, of course, is that as the results came in and it became clear that Trump was going to rout Cruz in Indiana and Cruz was going to get 0 delegates out of it, Ted Cruz announced that he was dropping out. And I think it's an interesting contrast between Cruz and Sanders. Both of them have been billed as kind of the ideological wings of their party. They're there fighting the good fight. But Cruz's decision to get out is a pretty pragmatic decision. I mean, he could have taken the choice that, look, I'm fighting for the quote-unquote soul of the Republican Party. I hate that phrase because parties don't really have souls. But he might have said, I'm going to fight the good fight. I'm going to stay because it's important to define the party as a truly conservative party. Instead, he's, you know, he said discretion is the better part of honor, and he's getting out. And Sanders has not quite done that, despite intense pressure to do so.
Yeah, I mean, Bernie's getting in there. I guess the, you know, the burn's going to stay there for a while. So, yeah.
And it'll be interesting to see what happens when Ted Cruz comes back to Texas, too. I mean, Ted Cruz, I mean, I think one thing that you do get from there, I don't think there's anybody that doesn't expect Ted Cruz to come back in 2020, no matter who wins the general election. And so he'll come back to Texas. He'll retake his Senate seat. He's still got, you know, 2 years left in that term, more or less. He's going to get not exactly a hero's reception when he goes back to the Senate, where he's, you know, been very unpopular already and spent his presidential campaign thumping on his, talking trash about his, and thumping his former colleagues. But he's going to go back nonetheless, and I think he's likely to run for re-election because he's going to need a platform for both fundraising and for running for office as he, I mean, I think the 2020 campaign starts tomorrow, basically, so for him.
Yeah, I mean, so one of the things we need to point out about Ted Cruz is that he's had a horrible, god-awful, no-good week. So as soon as we finished taping on Wednesday, we found out that he had announced Carly Fiorina as his running mate, which was a little bit odd considering he wasn't the nominee yet, but he picked a running mate, Carly Fiorina. Well, we knew things were going to start off poorly because I think in the first speech that she gives as part of the Cruz campaign, she falls off the stage and Ted Cruz doesn't notice it. That becomes problematic. Then as it goes into Indiana, things just go from bad to worse to god-awful to, oh, Lord, please pray for his soul. He goes to Indiana, the Hoosier State, which is known for basketball, and stands on a basketball court and refers to a basketball hoop as a basketball ring. Strike one. Then things got even worse.
I like the way you mixed in the baseball metaphor, the basketball story.
That's right. Yeah.
And then he missed the extra point.
Yes, he missed the extra point and was sent to the penalty box. Then after that, he was at a rally and a 10-year-old walked up and started heckling him, yelled out, "You suck." And the 10-year-old was escorted out by himself. So from what we could tell, the 10-year-old walked into the rally by himself, heckled Ted Cruz by himself, and left by himself.
It's a great illustration of how Cruz was like sort of a reduced version of all the action on the Trump side. You know, it's a bad scene, but over at the Trump rallies, you're getting fist fights and people going after it. At the Ted Cruz rally, it's a 10-year-old getting escorted out by security.
Yes, it's pretty rough. Then he gets into a shouting match, but a debate with a Trump supporter who's like, "Get out of here! Indiana doesn't want you." We just referred to a man in sunglasses. But I think the example of you're the guy in high school nobody likes, right, is when somebody said, Senator Cruz, I want to shake your hand. Ted Cruz reaches out his hand, the guy reaches out his hand, and just as they're about to shake, "Too slow, Joe," and told him he looks like a fish monster. That was just how the people of Indiana treated him. Let's get to how Donald Trump treated him.
Yeah, Donald Trump, let's just roll some sound here.
And, you know, his father was with Lee Harvey Oswald prior to Oswald's being, shot. I mean, the whole thing is ridiculous. What is this right prior to his being shot? And nobody even brings it up. I mean, they don't even talk about that. That was reported, and nobody talks about it. But I think it's horrible. I think it's absolutely horrible that a man can go and do that, what he's saying.
So, like, when you know your week is going bad when people are telling you your daddy helped kill JFK.
Well, remember, he's also been accused of being the Zodiac killer.
Right, that's the other meme from the week.
And so his wife had to actually actively defend him, saying, "No, he's not the Zodiac killer." The Zodiac killer was a serial killer in Northern California. But this was like 40 years ago or something like that. So,
70s.
Yeah, in the 70s. So, again, Ted Cruz was not old enough to do that. But, hey, let's blame Ted for everything. So the National Enquirer is running a story with a picture of Lee Harvey Oswald and a man standing next to Lee Harvey Oswald handing out pro-Castro pamphlets, and they argue that the man is Rafael Cruz, Ted Cruz's father.
He's been very active surrogate in the campaign.
Yes, and so his father's been very active. His father's been actually very political. He's a minister, and so he's very famous for his sermons, things of that nature. But this has been, and so the problem is you can't prove that wasn't Cruz's father that was in there, but people like, just because he was with, it's this idea that he was with Lee Harvey Oswald a couple of days before he shot Kennedy, meant he was part of it. That was just bad. Now, again, you could tell it was getting to Ted Cruz because then you get Ted Cruz's response. So let's roll that.
And he combines being a pathological liar. And I say pathological because I actually think Donald, if you hooked him up to a lie detector test, he could say one thing in the morning, one thing at noon, and one thing in the evening, all contradictory, and he'd pass the lie detector test each time. Whatever lie he's telling at that minute, he believes it. But the man is utterly amoral. Let me finish this, please. The man is utterly amoral. Morality does not exist for him.
The presumptive candidate, described by the runner-up as a pathological liar.
And amoral.
And those were some of the nicer things he said, really. He called him a serial philanderer, several other things. So this was really what the denouement of the GOP race has looked like. That's going to emerge with Donald Trump as the Republican nominee, unless something cataclysmic happens. But he's on the glide path. Everyone's in the state of, acceptance. But it was, driven in part by the fact that as Cruz emerged as an alternative, there were two things that I think were the predicate for Cruz's candidacy in his mind, in his analysis of the world and the Republican Party, that just didn't really come true. One, that there was this huge groundswell of ideological conservatives out there that would come out of the woodworks to support his candidacy. And second, that the Republican Party really is and should be a narrower, ideologically conservative party. Donald Trump has, sort of given lie to both of those, and it'll be interesting now to see where Cruz goes next, not only in Texas, but whether he tries to broaden his appeal, what happens. And of course, there is the fact that, many people were pointing out today, I think with varying degrees of gusto, that Cruz's unlikability was one of his key problems. I mean, one might say, maybe there is a conservative groundswell out there, it's just Ted Cruz can't really get it. I think there's something to that, but the numbers suggest that there isn't this broad base of conservatism, at least in the way that Ted Cruz constructs it.
Yeah.
That there's something else out there that Trump has mobilized that's more broad and adjacent to that kind of conservatism, but not the same thing. This native, we talked about nativism, mm-hmm. and et cetera.
Yeah, but again, going back to Ted Cruz's likability, and you clearly see this with the way people were just making fun of him in Indiana, is it doesn't help when the former Speaker of the House refers to you as the devil in the flesh. So that also happened to him last week. That I think he was also referred to as an all-around SOB. So I'm like,
yeah.
Like it ain't getting better for him. And so part of it is a combination of his personality, but also maybe part of an issue of his ideology that, you have an ideology that we're not that keen on, plus we don't like you. Has been kind of refrain. He was like, "Oh, I can buy into some of that, but if you weren't so annoying." And so, think of him as the hipster of the GOP. So most people are like, "Oh yeah, hipsters, they offer a few good things, but my lord, they're annoying." And get a mustache that looks like not like Raleigh Fingers, like your escape from a Keystone Cops movie. So I think that's kind of what's going on there.
You're going to have to Google Raleigh Fingers.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
Okay, and I guess before we leave, I feel like we're just kind of giving Ted Cruz a kick in like everyone else. But before we leave, it's as if Ted Cruz's week wasn't bad enough as he was going up to do, doing his concession speech. As he went to hug his father, he clocked his wife. So that's there's a vine out there of the whole sequence.
Oh, it was a two-piece.
If you look at the vine, it looks like he actually hits her like three times.
Yeah. He reached out to hug his father. But in the process of reaching out to hugging his father, he hits his wife in the face. But as he's hugging his father, he elbows her. Then as he goes back, it's like, oh, I'm sorry, hits her again, then hugs her. look, this man has had a bad week. And I'm not going to sit here and go out to Ted Cruz. You know, like, this man just had a bad week. And everything kind of fell apart in 1 week very quickly. But I do think, you know, it's not over. I think he still has some level of popularity in Texas. I think he can win his reelection for the Senate. And if he does run for president again, I think he will try to retool things. Let's also remember, Hillary Clinton had a whole bunch of missteps 8 years ago. And, you know, she's been able to retool, being able to reshape her image in that light.
So yeah, I mean, there's a certain irony to the fact that, you know, Cruz is fighting. This has been a year in which everybody's been fighting against business as usual. And Donald Trump has confounded all of our expectations. But one thing we may well be seeing here is at least the possibility of the reassertion of a traditional pattern in which the person who comes in second actually waits in the wings and is viewed by the Republican establishment as having taken their turn in the next cycle. Now, this is again where Cruz's, it's not so much his public likability as his ability to mend fences with insiders that I think will be a big piece of that.
Yeah, I think there are going to be a lot of pool parties, a little call me maybe. Put on that charm. You know what I'm saying? I think he's gonna become smooth again. Put on that Teddy Pendergrass, little DeBarge. You know, get it moving. Just, you know, just walk up to John Cornyn like, John, I know things have been rough between us. But I want to heal that relationship, John. What can we do? I think we're gonna see the Mac come out of Ted Cruz, and Ted Cruz will again 4 years from now. You know, who come out smooth as can be and be ready to go.
That made me feel real weird right there, I got to say.
Hey, get in touch with your feelings.
So going from, I'm in touch with them, I think, on this front. So going from the national to the local, although we'll pop back up, one of the big stories, at least in the UT area in Austin, but it has implications for the state, is the election going on right now and voting day. The election day will actually be Saturday. Early voting's been going on for a couple weeks now. On ride sharing in Austin. And so Proposition 1 was written essentially by the ride sharing companies, by Lyft and Uber, to essentially prevent the city from being able to enforce fingerprint checks on the ride share companies for their drivers who are employees, even though they don't call them that. A no vote against Proposition 2 would revert back to the existing ordinance in the city, which would require fingerprint checks and would also provide for more limitations on drop-off and pick-off and pick-up in traffic, et cetera. Really would align the ride-sharing companies a little bit more with the requirements on taxi cabs and limousine services, et cetera. This has been a big issue here in Austin, but it's also got continuity with national and even international politics. So the big story on this in the state is that when we looked at the most recent campaign finance disclosures last week, the proponents for Uber and Lyft, and it's mainly been Uber, have spent $8.1 million on a municipal election, which is an incredible amount of money for a city election and a ballot measure. And so the question is, are they going to buy it or not? And how could they have spent that much money? And I think the smart analysis to that is that, you know, Uber and Lyft have a lot riding on this. Their economic model, you know, looks at these city regulations basically as a cost. And they're trying to spend on the front end to reduce those costs and send signals to other cities that are considering these kind of regulations. And so what really appears to be a very localized fight over a city ordinance actually has national and international implications for both how this business model works and the role of these corporations in spending directly in politics.
Yeah, and what's important to note about Prop 1 is that it's a double negative, that if you want to keep a city ordinance going, so if you're saying yes to the city ordinance, you vote no on Prop 1. And this is a bit of confusion, where if you vote yes on Prop 1, you're saying get rid of the ordinance. And it's because Prop 1 is all
and
about
replace it with the new one.
Yeah, yeah. It's all about removing an ordinance, replacing it with a new one. So if you like what the city council passed, you vote no. If you don't like it, you vote yes. Now, what's important to note is that, again, with these $8.1 million being spent, is there's a lot of activity here, mainly because these types of ordinances have been passed in San Antonio and in Houston, and Uber and Lyft have left these cities because of this. And
well, they've left some cities but stayed in others.
Yeah, they've left, yeah, left some and stayed in others. And so there's kind of this risk of like, oh, we're going to leave you. But there's also this this safety concern. So if you think about the Uber driver who went on the shooting spree in Michigan, if you think of the fact that Uber has allowed their background checks have not been good, where sexual predators have been able to become Uber drivers, this has become one of the big issues. And you're actually seeing, again, with these services, specifically in regards to protecting women, where there's one that you only have female drivers and for female passengers, that's becoming a big thing now, that there is this safety concern. And you know, there have been some slips within these background checks. Now, that's not to say that the city's background checks will be better. It's just to say that the city will try to be more stringent in what they're doing. And so there's still going to be some holes within this no matter what happens. And so this is going to be really one of the major issues in terms of how we're seeing basically changes in ride-sharing services, things like that, but also the role of regulation. And to what degree are you going to regulate a certain industry? And to what degree can that industry fight back against this regulation, specifically by appealing to the public to fight back against this regulation?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of different ways that you can frame this, if you know, in trying to be fair about it. I mean, I think a lot of the people that are in favor of the ordinance point to a couple things. One, they point to the fact that, you know, cab service in Austin has never been particularly popular or well reviewed. And the taxi companies are an established interest. They're basically, if you will, the incumbents in this regulatory structure. And you can think of the ride-sharing companies as new entrants to the market. And as such, the argument is that, you know, the argument that the defenders of the ride-sharing companies will make is that essentially the cab companies want to force this same system that they're under on the ride-sharing companies just as a matter of increasing their costs and as a competitive measure favoring the cab companies. But I think certainly the ride-sharing companies have done some polling. Not much of it has been made, none of it that I know of has been made public, that probably discovered some of the things that we've seen in some other polling that we've done on transportation, which is that safety and public safety are major concerns when you start talking to people about transportation. So what's really rubbed some people the wrong way is that the Prop 1 ads really sort of suggest that a vote for Prop 1 is a vote for more public safety when in fact the checks are less stringent. And this has rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. The other piece to understand here is that Uber and Lyft have said from the beginning, and again, Uber has been the main player in this, that if the ordinance passes, they will leave the market. So if you're at a university, if you're at one of the universities in Austin, you've doubtlessly seen the paid Uber operatives handing out flyers and information saying, vote for Prop 1 to keep Uber in Austin. And so there's a certain amount of this that's kind of a game of chicken. It also folds into some other things that we've talked about throughout the semester in this newscast, that there's a real struggle going on right now between local government and the ability of local governments to execute rulemaking within their borders and other elements, both state government and private businesses, trying to push back against the cities and at the state level really limit the ability of cities to do things. We're seeing that in property taxes in the state legislature. We saw it in the last legislative session on fracking, which I think we talked about in here, where the city of Denton passed a ban on fracking. It was challenged in court by the oil companies and then overturned in the legislature in a way that also prohibited other cities from trying to limit fracking and the oil business, oil activity inside city limits. So, you know, this has a lot to do with, you know, whether you can take an Uber or not and, you know, the fight between Uber and the cabs. But it's also part of a much bigger dynamic that I think we're going to see a lot more of going forward in politics and particularly in Texas.
Yeah, I think that's extremely important what you pointed out, Jim. Many times we talk about federalism, we talk about the fight between the state and the federal government, but we're seeing right now with the fracking bill, we're seeing like now with the state LGBT, some of the laws being passed, that you get these fights between city and state. So you see this in Arkansas, Indiana, North Carolina. And so this is an extremely important aspect to talk about. And this is something you'll see going on as time goes on.
Yeah, we talked about it with the bathroom bill, too, and social issues. Yeah.
Now, we want to take us back to the national level and go to the Press Correspondents' Dinner. So this is something that's held every year where the president and first lady and usually a number of high-level political officials have a dinner with members of the press corps. You see a lot of celebrities there. So, like, Will Smith was there.
Yeah, it's become a real celebrity fest. What do you think of that?
I could really care less.
Do you care?
It's award show season time, I guess, and so this is a new award show. And it really, really began to get more attention by the keynote speakers, usually the comedian, and usually takes on a style of a roast. 10 years ago, when Stephen Colbert was the speaker, he was a speaker during the Bush presidency. He, let's just say, made everybody in the room feel uncomfortable. Everybody outside the room laughed.
Right. He did it in his character as the conservative talk show host.
Yeah.
And he, you know, went up there and, you know, sort of gave the press a hard time, you know, congratulated the press for doing such a bad job of covering Iraq. So you guys were real patriots for doing such a crappy job of covering the war, and it burned everybody in the room. He just burned the place down.
Yeah, and so Larry Wilmore did a little bit of this this year, and some people said Larry Wilmore bombed. No. He may have done horrible in the room. From what I can tell, he did very well with the public.
Which is how the Colbert thing played.
Yeah, and so the idea is, in many ways, it came off as a roast. It was like, you know, and the press... One thing I've noticed about the press is they have no problem grilling other people, but they have a hard time being grilled themselves.
Reporters can be amazingly thin-skinned. Yes. I'm friends with many, and, you know, they can be, you know, they're tough guys about a lot of things, but you start talking about, you know, them maybe being too easy on people, and they get their backs up. The other thing, so the set pieces on this is always that you have, the president always gives a speech, and one of the things that we really discovered in during the Obama presidency, is that President Obama is a very talented deliverer of comedy. His timing's really good. He knows a good joke when he sees it, you know, so he doesn't write them all himself. They have writers contribute to the jokes, but he's been very good.
Oh yeah, so let's show you some of his best one-liners, specifically in regard to the 2016 election.
Although while in England, I did have lunch with Her Majesty the Queen, took in a performance of Shakespeare, hit the links with David Cameron, just in case anybody is still debating whether I'm black enough. I think that settles the debate. I am hurt, though, Bernie, that you've been distancing yourself a little from me. I mean, that's just not something that you do to your comrade. Bernie's slogan has helped his campaign catch fire among young people. Feel the burn. Feel the burn. It's a good slogan. Hillary's slogan has not had the same effect. Let's see this. Meanwhile, some candidates aren't polling high enough to qualify for their own joke tonight. Then there's Ted Cruz. Ted had a tough week. He went to Indiana, Hoosier country, stood on a basketball court, and called the hoop a basketball ring. What else is in his lexicon? Baseball sticks? Football hats? But sure, I'm the foreign one. And there's one area where Donald's experience could be invaluable, and that's closing Guantanamo. Because Trump knows a thing or two about running waterfront properties into the ground.
All right, so as we see, that's President Obama getting his jokes in for his last press corps dinner. So we want to take this time to wrap up and tell you thank you for a great semester. If you are interested in online courses, there are a number of online courses that you can take this summer as well as in the fall. So please look at the schedule. So again, Jim has his Texas Politics course, which is a great class. There'll also be Introduction to Foreign Policy. And then also this course will be offered over the summer as well. So we again, if you're interested in taking these classes online, if you enjoyed this experience, there's something you can do over the summer. And if you know somebody who might be interested in this, please have them sign up. We'd be happy to have you. So again, for the end of the semester, thank you all. Have a good week and have a good summer.
Thanks a lot, and thanks to our crew.
It's done a great job. Great crew. They picked out this jacket.
The Government 310 in the News podcast is hosted by Drs. Jim Henson and Eric McDaniel, and is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio and the Department of Government in the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.